Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to This Irish American Life. My name is Dr. Miriam Nighan Gray, and I will be your host on Saturdays from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can tune in to us on WNYE 91.5 FM in the tri-state area and worldwide on www.nyuirish.net/radiohour, as well as on irishradio.com. We come to you every week in collaboration with Irish Radio Network USA, care of Mr. Adrian Flanley. For those of you who don't already know, Glucksman Ireland House is NYU's Centre for Irish and Irish American Studies. Inspired by the vision and philanthropy of Lewis L. Glucksman and Loretta Brennan Glucksman, Glucksman Ireland House NYU has evolved into a vibrant and world-renowned centre for the study of Ireland, Irish America, and the global Irish since its founding in 1993. We're coming to you today from our home, which is an elegant townhouse at Washington Mews and Fifth Avenue in New York City's Greenwich Village. Well, folks, I hope you had a good week, and we have been winding up our Black, Brown, and Green Voices series this week. We had a great lecture from Christine Keneally, professor from Quinnipiac University, on Thursday, which closed out our spring installments on this important programming. We will return in the fall with it, and I'll be delighted to share with you the audio from the conversation I had with Christine on Thursday on next week's program. On this week's show, folks, I just wanted to take a moment for us to reflect and get some perspectives on what's going on in the world around us. In that vein, I am going to have Lenwood Sloan on to have a chat with me about his perspectives on this watershed moment in American and perhaps world history. And then I'm going to speak to Deirdre Harkins. Both Lenwood and Deirdre have contributed to our Black, Brown and Green oral history collection for the Archives of Irish America. And I just reconnected with them this week to get their perspective on the events that are unfolding. I think it's important and vital that we do as much as we can in terms of understanding what's going on and why it's going on, and hopefully reaching a better understanding of unity and harmony and reconciliation and, most of all, empathy. There seems to be a lacking of empathy in this world right now. I'm going to kick off the program, folks, with a musical tribute memorial. I'm very grateful to musicians May and Henry for putting this together this week. They compiled it, and I'm airing it as a musical tribute to Mr. George Floyd, to Ahmaud Arbery, to Breonna Taylor, and to, unfortunately, that long list of people, going back to people like Emmett Till, and unfortunately even names that we don't know of people who have lost their lives due to hatred and bigotry. So this musical tribute is 8 minutes and 46 seconds, which is a timing ingrained in all our collective memories now in terms of how long he remained under the knee of that individual who took his life. So I'm kicking off the program with that, as I say, as a meditation on this all, folks. And we'll then go into chats with Lenwood and with Deirdre. And we'll close out with some of May and Henry's music at the end. I'm very grateful for their generosity in putting this together. Great musicians, and we're big fans of what they do. So we'll just start the program, folks, with 8 minutes and 46 seconds of reflection and remembrance. Thank you.
fire, empty room for his choir.
Thank you. I'm delighted to welcome to This Irish American Life a voice that will be familiar. It's not that long, actually, since we heard from Lenwood Sloan. Lenny, welcome back. And this is actually the first time I've spoken to you. Your voice has lit up and energized our airwaves, but not in a conversation in this medium. So welcome, firstly, to the program, and thank you for taking the time out to chat to me today. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you very much. It's always a joy to be with you and an opportunity to speak and engage with Ireland through the medium of radio and television.
Can I ask you, Lenny, I would say, unfortunately, you're a seasoned campaigner in terms of watching the evolution and the history of, in fact, the civil rights movement and changes and attitudes toward race as a defining feature in American society. From the vantage point that we are at now in this moment, in this what feels like a watershed period in American and maybe global history, how do you look back on your early participation? And maybe you can share with me and your listeners some of the activism that you've been involved in over decades now, I believe.
Well, you know, one of my favorite photographs is a march of Martin Luther King from the Selma Bridge to Montgomery. And in that photograph is a priest and a rabbi and Robert Kennedy and Paul Newman, and you see this solidarity. That is what frightened the arbiters and the controllers of power so much at that time. As long as black people were marching by themselves, they thought that they could be contained and controlled. But when you suddenly have a Catholic priest, a Jewish rabbi, an imam, several stars who should have stayed in their place on the silver screen, several voices who should have remained on the bandstand, meeting together and marching together. When you suddenly had young people of every color in the streets together, that was what was dangerous. The knitting of America was dangerous. You know, I want to say to my Irish friends that George Custer, and we know George Custer from the movies, from Custer's Last Stand, you know, and his Indian kind of antics and aggressions of Native Americans. But George Custer was an Irish general in the Civil War. He wrote a letter to Abraham Lincoln that said to Lincoln, the greatest fear we have is that black and Irishmen will unite in their struggle for equity and parity. And we must do everything we can. This is a letter to Abraham Lincoln, you all, by the way. You know, everybody thinks that Lincoln was totally about the freedom of the enslaved and the full equity. But Lincoln said, if I could save the Union by keeping slavery, I would. If I could save the Union by ending slavery, I would. I would do whatever I can to save the Union. So Lincoln's position was not about lifting up black Americans and enslaved people. It was about saving the Union. So he asked Custer, this Irishman, what can we do? And Custer writes back to him, we can keep these people apart. You know, if we ever allow there to be solidarity in America between Irish Americans and African Americans, primarily freemen, not enslavement, that we will lose America. What America? You know, when we talk about make America great again, for who? For what? What America are we making great? Custer's words resonate for me because It was the full frontal attack against amalgamation, and it worked. You know, it worked. So what's happening in the streets now and what's happening in the streets then was about doing everything we can to keep these people not only apart, but agitated against each other. I call those the agitationists, you know, and they are at full work and at full bloom right now. So that picture, I keep that picture of the Selma March and all of those people together, because that was what was so frightening, is that the possibility of solidarity. So too of Malcolm X. As long as Malcolm X was talking about separatism, you know, he was contained. When he began to talk about inclusion, that's what was dangerous. You know, the discussions of inclusion are dangerous, at least in America, to the arbiters and the power structure. What we have going on now in America is the last gasp of battle for a kind of, forgive me, old white men who do not even see the power and the privilege of young white men achieving the American dream. They are constitutionalists about who is in and who is out. When I was a child, my grandfather was a deacon at the Baptist church, and we had been growing up in that church, and all of my friends went to this Presbyterian church. The Presbyterian church had a swimming pool, and it had a basketball court, and it had a Boy Scouts, you know. So I went to my grandfather one day, and I said, you know what, I think I'm going to become Presbyterian. And he said, what, you know, what are you talking about? You know, we're Baptists, and that's it. I said, no, I'm old enough to decide now, you know, that the God of the Baptists is the God of the Presbyterians, and I'm going to become Presbyterian. It was one of the best things I did and one of the most intelligent moves I made, because the minister of that Presbyterian church was the Reverend Dr. Leroy Patrick, who had graduated from Lincoln University. And on the eve of my joining that church, he was calling young people together to go with him to integrate the Highland Park swimming pool in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. That was my first civil rights act. We went swimming in the white swimming pool with Reverend Patrick, and that was my introduction. Later on, Reverend Patrick was gathering young people to go to Selma and to Montgomery, and you were to have a pair of black trousers and a white shirt and a black bow tie. You were to have $100 in your shoe, and I came from very, very poor working class family. I had to raise my own $100. The $100 was your bail money. You know, they put you on a bus, they gave you a box of chicken, and they drove you strategically to a place. You were supposed to get off your bus, and you were supposed to walk 20 miles to where other buses were, and your bus would be waiting for you to get back on. That's how the movement advanced behind John Lewis and behind all these great young people then. John Lewis was 23 years old then. We were kids. We had no idea of the danger and the possibility. When you look at the pictures of Birmingham sicking the dogs on kids, you know, and using the hoses, Martin and Rosa Parks and all that, they were young people, like the young people who are in the street today, you know, and they used young people in their movement, you know. Would I have gone if I understood how dangerous that was? Probably not. But my faith and my trust in the leadership said, fall behind them, you know, and have your $100 ready in your bell, you know, and,
And did you need the $100?
We were stopped and impounded and forced back on the bus. So we only watched later on the horror of other churches and other groups of students who were willing to put themselves physically in the way of change, you know. But so that was the kind of beginning of my when I went to Temple University, my father is a Democrat. He'd been a Democrat all of his life, although he said vote for the best man, not for the party. But we were out at age 10 passing out leaflets on corners for people who were trying to get elected to make change. So when I got to Temple University in 1966 and I opened the student newspaper, there was an organization called Students for Democratic Society. You know, I said, oh, I'm going to join the student. Well, that was a leftist radical group that was on a hit list of, American presidents in general and the FBI, the members. So I went on a list of, when I tried later on to get into VISTA, Volunteers in Service to America, they said, no, you had belonged to a leftist group. I was like, I just thought it was a Democratic club, you know. And I remember being on Temple University's campus in 1968 when the Students for a Democratic Society rioted and the police under Frank Rizzo came onto the campus and gassed us. That was the first time I had taken in tear gas and the first time that I felt that violence of fleeing but not knowing where to run, you know. And I was in Philadelphia the night that Martin Luther King was assassinated, and I watched the city burn. And I was in Philadelphia. This is the 35th anniversary of the bombing of MOVE, a neighborhood in Philadelphia that was bombed, the only other place besides Pearl Harbor that was bombed. And so I know the visceral fear. I know the toxic smell of tear gas. I know the kind of way your skin prickles when you don't know where to go, but you know that you have to take your stand anyway. And that has kind of galvanized me. I this morning watched John Lewis speak. Now John Lewis is a very old man and a very ill man with cancer, you know, and he had tears in his eyes that he said, we never thought that we would be here again. But as a historian, I have to remember, this is a cycle. This is not a staircase up. This is a pendulum. And we swing to one arc, and then it swings back on us, you know. So we must remain forever vigilant, you know, and forever resist the diminishment of our rights for equality, parity, and citizenship. Well, this is just another time. This is just another war. And this will just require another set of young people, recruits, to take the place of those elders who, and we need to pass the flag to them. But this is a different time because they have cell phones and they have, you know, Twitter, and they have Instagram, and, you know, they can capture immediately both the facts on the street and the spirit of their kind and their age. And they can call up armies in an instant in a way that we can't. They can call up armies across the world. And that's why there are armies of young people in the street of every city in the world right now, crying for justice and demanding change. And their first battle is around police injustice.
In that period, I guess slightly later, Lenny, in the late 60s and then into the early 70s, Were you aware that the civil rights movement here, and the, you know, the imagery and the iconography and the songs and the popular culture that was surrounding the civil rights movement here would reverberate to some extent in a place like in Ireland, like in Northern Ireland? Were you conscious of that at the time at all, Lenny?
Well, you know, I have spent my last 30 or 40 years with Mick Maloney looking at not the the battle between blacks and Irish, but the common grounds and the common solidarities. And so resistance of oppression is a common ground, you know, and the solidarity that Frederick Douglass and Daniel O'Connell wrote about, the solidarity that happened just recently with Ireland sending Native American support around the coronavirus in response to a time when those same tribesmen sent their precious dollars to the Irish for the famine. Those are the places that I look to in the battle for equity and parity. Those places. I don't look at 400 or 500 race riots between blacks and Irish now that I've conquered, but I look at the kind of places where they have come together through the common use of their voice and taking to the streets to try to achieve some kind of equity and parity. But I have to tell you that last year was the 50th anniversary of Vietnam, and we did this thing called the homecoming, where we welcomed Vietnam soldiers back home because they were the first armies in America who we turned our backs on. And one of the soldiers asked me, when do you think that the Vietnam War movement ended? And I say, it ended at Kent State. It ended in the middle of the afternoon where America watched soldiers shoot down white students on a campus. You know, that shock that America would shoot its own kids on broad daylight, you know, over, you know, trying to repress the war. And that ended a movement, you know. These kids today, they're not singing "We Shall Overcome" someday. They're like, today's the day, you know. This is the day, you know. We're not going to do the someday bit again. You know, we watched. Somebody said, well, why don't you do it through legislation? You have to do it at every front. You know, but we have watched legislation not work. I need to remind people that the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Acts, are not privileges. They're acts. Acts expire, like the freshness on your milk carton, you know. And so we are still in a place where we are only given limited power, limited authority, limited privilege for full citizenship. And at any moment, it could expire. And we are beholden to those who are in power to reenact. You know? So I think that black folks in America are going to do what they need to do to be heard this time. That simply taking the knee or singing songs of peace, you know, is one strategy of the thing that needs many strategies. But I'm calling on white Americans in particular, and white men and women of conscience across the world in general, to join us in this action, because the people who are in power can change this. You know, the people who are in authority need to speak out. This is not a time for silence. And I'm not worried about the people who are with the guns. I'm worried about the people who are silent. I am worried about the people who are standing behind the yellow tape watching this go down and saying, I have sympathy for them. You have my prayers. No, we don't need no prayers anymore. You know, we need the powerful to use their power and their authority to make change beside us.
Lenny, I can think of no better way to conclude this chat today. And I thank you for coming on the program and for sharing your perspectives based on a lot of scholarship, a lot of engagement, a lot of outreach and activism that has added nuance and texture to your interpretations and how you see these things. It's an honor to have you here on this Irish American Life program, and I look forward to seeing you in person soon. And in the meantime, stay safe.
Thank you so much for your time.
I'm delighted to welcome to this Irish American Life Deirdre Harkins. Deirdre is, I guess I should welcome you, Deirdre. I'm going to welcome you wearing your NYU hat as a recent alum of NYU's World History Program, if I'm remembering the title of your degree correctly. Welcome to the program today, and thank you for taking the time out to speak to us. It's a real pleasure to have this opportunity.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
And I should say that Deirdre is a contributor to our Black, Brown and Green Voices interviews for the Archives of Irish America. And I know from your work at NYU, Deirdre, that you have done some research on historical research on the intersections of the African American and Irish American experience. I guess in particular in the context of you as someone who shares both those identities as Irish American and African American. I guess, Deirdre, what I would love to get a perspective from you as a young person, what kind of conversations have the events over the last few weeks unfolded for you or opened up for you, or how have you been framing these massive changes and conversations and activities around, identity and injustice and discrimination?
So at first, when I first heard it happened, I didn't really think it would get this much publicity, or it would just pass by really quickly. But it seems like this one is kind of like the tipping point for a lot of people, or it's opening up a lot of people's eyes. So at home,
and by Deirdre, you mean the death of Mr. George Floyd,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Okay.
I think because that one was just so heartbreaking to see, and especially because he was calling out for his mom, and so I think that really hit a lot of heartstrings. So at home, we've had this conversation. We talked about it. I didn't really watch the whole video because it was just too sad to see, it's all over the news, of course, and with my friends, they're protesting, and I didn't expect them to, because they're pretty quiet normally, but other family members, they're not really getting it to an extent, so it's a bit frustrating, and I don't usually speak about my political opinions or really try to express my opinions on Facebook or Instagram or anything, just because I don't want to start arguments online with family members that I really don't think I could get like my opinions across to very well. But I did this time because it was just extremely frustrating to consistently see on Facebook people saying all lives matter. And of course they do. It was just they were missing the point of the whole movement, the Black Lives Matter movement. So it was like, I'm really happy to see a lot of people that I didn't expect from like high school and college to promote and support the Black Lives Matter movement. But then I'm also seeing a lot of, I hate saying the phrase fake news, but a lot of fake news that people are just saying to rile people up. So it's been a lot, because I like that it's being talked about, but I don't like that a lot of things are being portrayed poorly, if that makes sense. I don't really know, but it's a good thing and then also a bad thing, because the rioters people have, they're connecting that completely with the protests, and then it's just making a lot of people antsy and scared. Like up here in Westchester, in the suburbs, people were knocking on our door saying, hey, the protesters are coming, the rioters are coming, lock your doors, lock your cars, turn off your lights. And we're like, up here? How are they going to get here if they're not driving up here, first of all? And plus, it's super dark. It was like 8 p.m., 9 p.m. But we didn't really expect much to happen. It's a very residential neighborhood. And it was just, I think a lot of people are spreading false information to just get people into a frenzy. So it's like a lot of things happening all at once. Mm-hmm.
In this sense, I know I've been noticing the same, Deirdre. I'm probably not as, I'm a generation older than you, and I'm not as engaged with social media quite to the same extent that you are. But as a historian, as someone like you who's done a lot of historical training, that's one of the frustrating elements, is how much of a bonus the internet is in disseminating information, but sometimes the types of that information, and it's difficult to discern what is, you know, quote unquote good information, meaning accurate as opposed to inaccurate information, right?
Yeah. Like, there are people that I know from high school that are saying they need to not be silent. These are white people I went to high school with, and I'm like, this is really great. You're speaking about things you support, things you may not have supported years ago, but they keep just reposting things from other people, reposting information that they don't even know where it's from or if it's true. And I just, and if it is true, definitely post it, but do a fact check first, of course. And I don't really see that happening. And people are just going to get angrier and angrier if they see these things, and they're also not fact checking. So as much time as it takes to fact check certain things, I still think it's a thing that people need to do for in this time, even though it's the whole thing is just very frustrating.
In recent days, Deirdre, the former president of the United States, Barack Obama, has come out and injected on one level narratives of hope into what's going on and framing it. And really the messages I've taken from that have been about your generation and my children's generation in terms of a capacity for change. I'm heartened to hear that you have seen change within your generation, even in terms of attitudes. Do you feel hopeful about that? You know, do you share that perspective?
Yeah, I think that things have definitely changed. Even just all these people that I've known for most of my life, like through school, I know that they said really ignorant things in middle school and high school, and I'm sure that their parents were influences on that. And to see them now talk about going out and protesting and standing up for people's rights that they really don't have to stand up for, because it doesn't necessarily affect them directly. And even just seeing people just apologize. So many people have reached out to me recently apologizing in case they've ever been a certain way to me, because I think people were just kind of realizing, oh, maybe I was racist and didn't realize it, or maybe I've been an awful person. And I wish that they recognized this a long time ago. But of course, I feel like because it's all in our face right now and we have really nothing else to do being in quarantine, that it's giving them a sense of a time to think about the world, who they, like, what they've done, and then just change in general. There's so many people of so many different nationalities and ethnicities protesting in honor of George Floyd. Oh, I'm surprised, in so many different countries too. It's amazing. So I do think that there's some kind of change coming. I hope it's not. It's going to be scary regardless, but I hope it's not as scary as it seems it's going to be right now. Because change is scary, of course, but it is always necessary.
Deirdre, would you mind, I didn't ask you about this in advance, so I'm catching you off a little off guard, so please be free to say no, but I'd love you to share a little bit about the research. I think you did it for your thesis It was on a topic of 19th century African American and Irish history, or the paper you did on that Lady Nell. Was that, I don't know whether it was your final paper or your thesis, but can you tell our listeners a little bit about that research, if that's okay for you?
Yeah, sure. It was a final paper for a Irish women's studies class. I forgot the exact name of the class, so I'm sorry. Taught by Marion Casey. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to do research on Black and Irish communities in Brooklyn and in Manhattan. But there wasn't a lot of information to use, especially in such a short period of time, to write a paper for a class, just a final paper for a class. So I started doing research on Nell Butler, who was an Irish indentured servant, and I forget what years exactly. It was the 1600s, I believe. And she was brought over by one of the Lord Baltimores. It's been a bit since I've looked at the information. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But she was brought over to Maryland.
Barbados?
Yeah.
Oh, Maryland, okay.
Maryland, mm-hmm. With Lord Baltimore. And then she married a slave who they called Negro Charles. She had married him, and Lord Baltimore was really just disgusted that that was happening, and he's like, you are going to become a slave, because that was the way the laws in Maryland at the time were. And she said, I'd rather be a slave than work for you, or something like that. Or at least that's how the story goes. So she became a slave with Negro Charles, as they called him. And people remembered the wedding ceremony. They had there were documents of people talking about it. But then Lord Baltimore passed a law that whatever your mother was, you would also be. So since she was supposed to be a free white woman, if she didn't marry him, she would have been free. Her children would have been free. Later on, people were, her descendants were claiming that they were descendants of her, so that way they could become free based on new laws that happened or were passed as the years passed by. So, and people were winning, and they were gaining freedom. Slaves were running away, trying to gain freedom. And so the name Butler, everyone that had that name, they're like, yeah, I'm related to Eleanor Butler. That's my great, great, great grandmother and stuff like that. Wow. Of course, all the documents, it's hard to really trace, because I'm sure a lot of documents weren't recorded, or they're just lost or destroyed or something. Mm-hmm. But it was a really interesting topic, because it was kind of like a really far ahead precursor of like the Lovings versus Virginia, and I think it was 67 or just in the 60s, around that time span. And of course, interracial marriage is a very close thing to me, so I've always been really interested in that. But just seeing that this happened in like the 1600s, and it wasn't really a big deal at the time, because the people who talked about it, they were like, yeah, they got married, who cares? But it was a problem for Lord Baltimore and other lawmakers at the time.
Well, it's fascinating research, and I hope that at some point you have an opportunity, Deirdre, to return to it. It's, you know, it's always instructive to look to the past in terms of these, sometimes the past isn't all that distant, right? Yeah. Obviously slavery is over and things like that, but how rich our past can be in terms of lessons for our present. It's lovely to chat to you today, Deirdre, and I'm so happy and humbled that you've taken the time to come and speak to me for our listenership of this Irish American life, and to have the perspective of someone like you who is watching this unfold in a generational capacity, a bit different from me, and different maybe from other people listening in. And it's great to have this voice here in this medium. So thank you so much. Keep doing the work and recovering the voices of Irish Nell and Negro Charles, etc. And I hope to see you in person and not in the virtual world very soon.
Hopefully. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Deirdre. Thank you.
Thank you.
We're coming towards the end of the program. I'm Dr. Miriam Nighan-Gray, and I'd like to thank you for listening to This Irish American Life, coming to you on WNYE 91.5 FM in the tri-state area, and worldwide on www.nyuirish.net/radiohour, as well as on irishradio.com. We come to you every week in collaboration with Irish Radio Network, USA, care of Mr. Adrian Flanley. I'd like to thank May and Henry again for providing the extra music, the beautiful and poignant music in tribute for this week's program. And I'd like to thank you for tuning in. We have a saying in the Irish language, folks, which is Ní leart a chur le chéile, and what that means is there is no strength without unity. Powerful words. Have a good week, folks. Slán agus beannacht. Our theme music today was the opening set by The Gloaming, produced by Brassland and Real World Records.